No, I mean, architecture is political. We gotta add that stuff.
Indeed.
We're tearing down communities to build multifamily, and you have to understand we are creating displacement. You're displacing Black and brown folks, and they don't come back.
Half of this podcast would be dedicated to the history of Tyler House, my journey and my discoveries, and hey, I'm gonna solve this housing problem.
Hey guys, what's up? My name is Melissa Daniels. This is the Architecture is Political podcast where Black and brown folks talk about architecture. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and be part of my storytelling. Writing the Vortex was invited to do a presentation at AIA St. Louis. So it was Kathy Prigmore and I flew down, and we were joined by two other Black women who are from the St. Louis area. What we normally do at Writing the Vortex is each of us tell a story about ourselves and our architectural career. It's either Kathy Prigmore or Catherine Williams will go first, and they talk about the history of Vortex as well as the state of Black women in architecture. After that, the other panelists will talk about whatever it is that they feel like talking about pertaining to themselves and their career in architecture. The audience is usually filled with Black and brown people, usually majority Black women, a couple of Black men, and others. The crowd for this was different. And I've attended a good amount of Writing the Vortex presentations, and this is the first time me have experienced where the audience was not a majority of Black and brown people. And I was uncomfortable sharing my story to this audience. Everybody else was fine. They were letting it go. They were just like, this is what happened to me. No holds bar. Just putting everything out there. I was reserved. I was muted most of the conversation, surprisingly. I did chime in on some of the Q&As, but I was taken back. And it relates to this episode, actually, because it's about privilege. It's about uncomfortable conversations. I felt uncomfortable having a conversation with this particular crowd, although people online may have had a different story. So yeah, it was uncomfortable for me. And it was uncomfortable because there was no reaction. There was no questions from the majority white audience. One guy did ask a question. One or two guys, I believe, asked a question. I have no idea what was going on online. We were not privy to that or the discussions that were happening online. So I can't speak on that. But the audience that was in front of us, it was silence. It was this conversation that you're about to hear, as well as another one that's coming up. And we talked about that. We talked about the feelings and reactions white people have when we present them with our struggles, with our issues, with our fears, we are bringing our true selves forward and expressing our experiences in this industry. And all they do is listen. There was no questions, no follow-ups, no acknowledgement, I guess. Is that what I'm looking for? And, you know, I don't know. Of course, I'm not searching for permission. Or am I? Because, and it's weird for me to say that, right? It's weird for me to say that, for me to be my authentic self in front of white people, in front of white folks, in front of my peers who have dominated this industry from its inception. I don't know how I feel about that. And I'm trying to shake it off. I'm trying to be me. It's easier for me to say how I feel on this platform because no blue-eyed, blonde man with European history is not looking dead at me. It's easier for me to talk about my issues and struggles, whether I'm talking or writing. Now I get to talk to Susan, a native Virginian, who wants to have these conversations, not just with me, but with people who look like her, a white woman. It is Women's History Month. Prior to me going to St. Louis for this presentation, I had this whole other spiel about white women in architecture and how I left that group unofficially because I felt that there was no authenticity. It's now performative. It's now because we're still talking about the same topics that we was talking about 10 years ago. And has the needle truly moved? Has it? Maybe it has. Maybe it did move. But the issues are still there. With COVID and then the surge in remote work, I saw that as an opportunity to truly move the needle because now you have women who can actually be part of their households and not feel guilty staying in the office. But now that more and more offices, architectural firms, want you in the office, it's the same thing. And it's not just taking care of your family and doing like little extra chores here and there while you work. Because to be quite honest, that's what we do. In lieu of water cooler talk or coworker telling you about their vacation, I'd much rather do my laundry than to hear that. But we were finally finding a balance, and now it's not. And the chatter isn't about that. The conversations are still empowering, they're still uplifting, but to me, they're not real. There's no substance to that. Like, yes, I feel better, I feel encouraged, but my problem is still there. I'm still unbalanced. I feel like there really hasn't been any change, especially the way the U.S. is moving with all its political issues. We're not addressing it. We're not talking about it. Even though the conversations Susan and I had barely scratched the surface into what's going on. This is a candid conversation. And it was just me asking her questions. Because I've never... Okay, guys, this is the perspective I'm taking on this is that I never had an opportunity to talk to a white woman on this level that wasn't a coworker. Because it's different. I believe I've had conversations with white women who were coworkers of mine, or it was serving in some professional capacity. The great thing about Susan, I don't work for her. She don't work for me. It was just, she's pretty much a total stranger. And that allowed me a bit more comfort to just really get down and just ask the questions I've always wanted to ask. And she answered them. Also to understand that the conversations that Susan will be amongst her peers, right? Amongst other white women, amongst white men. This is not, how should I say this? This is not, I'm teaching her, I'm educating her so she could, no, it's not. Or she's trying to boost or be cool about, hey, I'm a cool white woman. No, it's not that at all. We talked prior. And we talk during and a little bit after. So it's not about that. It's about me asking questions that I have not been able to ask with another professional in this industry that's not a coworker or not a person who works at a firm that I may be interested in working in one day. That sort of thing. I hope that makes sense. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this conversation I have with Susan. Yeah, I hope you enjoy. Thanks. Susan, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Melissa.
So great to meet you. Can you just say a little bit about yourself for the audience?
Absolutely. First, I'm just honored to be here and thank you for
allowing me to share in a conversation with you. I am Susan Pilato, and I have two companies called one PCNA Business Environments. We are a bit unique in that we're a furniture dealership. We also own a company called Mantra Inspired Furniture, which we are super excited about. That was born out of a necessity for solid wood desk and for a client of ours, and we found no one was making that. We have been working with some Mennonite partners and for years who have a great connection with the Amish. And we have learned over and over again about the importance of sustainability and wood. So we're trying to spread that message of what does sustainability actually mean? Because there's a lot of greenwashing there, which is very connected to what I feel as whitewashing. We've got whitewashing, we've got greenwashing, and I'm fighting both. So that's me in a nutshell. I've been a commercial interior designer for 30 years. My business partner and I still going strong, and she's crazy enough to go on this ride with me. And I like to tell people I started when I was 12, but not so true. But I did start right out of college, and I'll tell you that something that my dad said to me, he said he knew my ambitions of wanting my own business one day and wanting to be a leader. He worked up through his corporation to where he eventually was part owner. He said, "Can't you do what I've done, work your way up?" And I'm like, "Dad, I'm a woman. It'll never happen if I don't do it on my own." And that ended the argument because he knew it was true. So that's why I jumped in as early as I did. I wanted to hit the ground running.
We're having a conversation, just getting uncomfortable with uncomfortable topics. I was excited to talk to you because I could get candid and real with you. I feel like it's a safe space because you're your own business woman, you have your own company, so you answer to yourself. You're not upholding to a corporation or anything like that.
Right.
So you're free to say whatever you want to say.
That's why I've worked so hard to get to the place I am today. So I have that freedom to really speak out and really actually make a difference. Not that I haven't been able to, but a lot of being my own boss is exactly what you're saying, Melissa.
Is architecture political? I've started this podcast with that title specifically because I've been told that we shouldn't politicize architecture. It should just be about the environment and people and the design mostly.
I guess it's how someone defines political, but with the layers that are within architecture and the effect that architecture has on people's lives, you're building, whether it's shelter, whether it's office space, it's where people reside during the day, through the night, what have you. It's where people go to be entertained. So how can you say it's not political? Because you have to design to the community, and oftentimes they're not designing to the community. They're designing to one thought of the community. Not to mention within the constraints of an architectural firm. I worked for a small firm when I first got out of college, so I didn't experience some of what I've heard my friends experience. There's hierarchies there.
What school did you go to?
I went to Virginia Tech. I used to have people say, "You major in interior design? That's a real major? They actually have a major?" Yeah. I'm used to being very underestimated. So.
How come you opted for interior design and not architecture?
Since I was a kid, I always wanted my own business. Didn't know what it was going to be. Loved working with my hands. When it was time, my dad, because of the connections he had some connections in Virginia Tech, and they said, "She really needs to take a test to see." Business is such a broad thing because I thought I was just going to go get a business degree. Once I took the test, they said, "Teacher or interior design?" I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "Oh, I like the idea of interior design. I like working." And so that's how that happened. And
So they
I
put you in a box because you're a woman.
put me in a box because exactly, I think that's exactly probably why those test results came out the way they did at the time. Now, I will tell you that when I graduated, I thought, "I'm going to go back and get my architecture degree." And then dad said, "Yeah, you do whatever you want. It's on you." And I'm like, maybe I'll work for a while and then go back. And then once I started getting into, because I'll tell you, when I did internships for this particular architectural firm, I did roofing detail. I did all these, I didn't know nothing with interior design, but what was great about that is because I understood it and I understood the systems and how they work together. It made me a better designer for when I did come out of school. But I just started working and loving design, and I was able to, I think at that time too, Melissa, let's be real, interior designer woman, it wasn't that big of a jump. And I had some friends that were women that did go through the architecture school. It was hard for them to break in. They did, but and I'm not one to run from a challenge, but I was able to get some headway where I was as a designer. So I stayed with it. Then the recession hit, and then everybody was laid off, and we were all surviving. So I was at this conference called Women's Wellness Conference, and it was over 100 ladies. And the acceptance, the authenticity, let's just say it was just talking about getting real. It's just you just it was so easy to just be real and to be authentic. And I've told them I can be myself more in this crowd than I can and many other crowds that I'm in. It's comforting to be just let down and just be. And I think that shocks some of them to hear that. And I can understand why. But there's just this, and I wonder where it's from, Melissa. Is it because of the trauma? Is it because with what's been taken away and pushed back and misunderstood that there is this appreciation for joy that these women have, and that's why I feel the realness. I don't know. I hear their stories, but when you can layer those stories, it's one thing to have something happen to you. Like I lost my mother when I was 13, but that happens to many people. I lost that connection that I wish so terribly that I had. I see the closeness of women with their mothers, and it's wonderful. It's such a wonderful bond. Not always. I had people then, they had a hard time understanding what to say to me because they didn't know what to say. So they didn't say anything at all, which was almost worse. I understand that when you don't talk about things and bring it out, the trauma just deepens and you're alone with it. So trauma, we all are going to go through something. How you can take that something, you can become bitter and angry and then spread that across, or you can share it, enjoy commonalities with other people who can build you up and can be your support system and help you through it. And that's what I have found with women. Women are really good. This idea that we are petty or that we want to drag each other down, I have never, through my business career, I've not encountered that with professional businesswomen. True professional businesswomen have, they've been the ones that have helped me move forward. I have it every day. Dr. Angela and I have talked about this. And it just, we have our own network. And that's where I feel very passionate about making sure that we include, because we understand how to include. We have that nurturing quality to us in our gen. And I think, quite frankly, I think, Melissa, really, the women are the ones that can make a big difference. And getting voices heard that haven't been heard loud enough, I think we have more of the power than the men do. And the way that we get really heard is if we can get in those rooms, and we're very strategic on how to get in those rooms, not to hurt the men, not to shut them down, but to get them to understand that we can make this all better and we can work with you if you work with us. They got to be willing to do that though.
I've been active in women in architecture. Started a women in architecture series for a good 5, maybe 7 years. I was doing it. I had to stop because I felt that I wasn't included in the white women groups. Like I felt I was an accessory. You have an outfit and I was just the earrings. It wasn't an exclusion. I felt that if I multiplied in that space, they will become the minority and there will be a level of uncomfort. They would just leave. If the quantity of minorities entered that space, they would start a new thing. Because I don't know why. Is there fear of being a minority? There's always women and minority, right? We can't just all be women. There's some pluses and minuses in that. The ultimate goal is to not deal with this whole race thing. I would love that. And every Black person I've ever met would love that. It's just we are constantly reminded that we are Black. We are constantly reminded that we are women. There's this whole systemic thing. I was at a showroom. They throw these holiday parties or whatever. And I was approached 2 times by white people regarding Obama. This is not a political atmosphere. This is a furniture showroom. And I'm here trying to win an iPad. This is why I'm here. And the topic of Obama comes up. And I'm like, what is the relevance of this? My husband and I went to LA and we went on the TMZ tour bus looking for celebrities. I want to see a Kardashian as an introduction, like where you're from and all this other stuff. And this guy was like, I'm from whatever city, state he's in, and I hate Obama. We're the only 2 Black people on the tour bus. Why would you mention that to us? It's like, why would you even bring that up? Would you have brought that up if we were in this space or not? The driver was a Black guy. I am constantly reminded of who I am in terms of how I look and my gender. A, does that ever happen to you? Like a reminder that you are a white woman. And then secondly, the fear of being the minority in the room at any given time. Is that a thing? Is that a fear? Have you talked to other white women regarding this?
Okay. First, I love what you say. You were there to win the iPad. So is everybody else, by the way, right? There is equality in there. Trying to get that iPad. But your point about people coming up to you and saying something about Obama, here's what I think they're doing. They're trying to connect with you. That might be a way of a connection to let you know they're safe for you to say whatever, that they're your safe place. They just don't know how to just.
But why? Like, why approach me as a Black woman? Why just approach me as a colleague or approach me as a potential client or approach me as a potential partnership? And I think that's the frustration because I just want to be me. Right.
Just as a person coming
in. As a human being.
I'm here for the same reasons you all are. Absolutely. As a human being seen. I think, and Melissa, this is part of what I really want to do and get out there and let's talk about these things because that person may, that white person may have had it in them to try to do the right thing, come to you and give you that, here's a connection, Melissa, I love Obama and here's blah, blah, blah. And maybe in their mind, it was like a way to open up a conversation. What they should have done was, hey, Melissa, tell me what projects are you working on? What's going on? And how did you get into architecture? Talk to you like they would anybody else. I think there is such a sense of, and this is again, going back now, and I'm talking about the people that really are the ones that we need to reach out to and bring over. The guy that's an idiot on TMZ bus, I just want to go up and slap him myself. And I probably would have had I been there. And that's the other, getting more of white people, when you see something, say something. Like when that happens, say something. And that's part of being in the room. So that person that was trying to connect with you, we need to teach them, thank you, but that's not how you need to connect with me. Just see me for who I am. And this idea of, oh, I don't see color. I'm colorblind. Oh, bullshit. That's just stupid to say. Black is beautiful. So why would you say that you don't see it as that? But you don't need to see it as the only thing that person is. That's what we got to say. And I don't want to be looked at as, oh gosh, here comes another white person. Because honestly, there's so many white people that have acted badly. It hurts me to talk to people authentically. If you want to go talk to someone and make them feel comfortable, and you are looking at that they're, the two of the only people of color in the room, and you're trying to make them just go talk to them. Don't start bringing up Beyonce or whatever.
When I'm in these spaces, sad to say, it happens more oftentimes than not. You have to be professional, and I don't know who I'm talking to. That's the thing, also, right? Who's approaching me with this? So I have to smile and
Gotta
be
be careful.
cordial and play this game. I'm curious into the mentality. Is it that the person isn't exposed to Black people as often? Why do you dig deeper in that thing, or do you, I what do you do
What do you do as a Black person?
in terms of you having a conversation with another white person regarding this, right?
Yes. Okay.
And
So,
yeah, or even like the TMZ bus, right? I don't want it all to, all I want to do is try to see Kanye. That's all I'm trying to see in Hollywood. Maybe see a Kevin Hart. That's what I'm trying to see. I don't want to, even though the gentleman said what he said, I wouldn't want another white person to confront him on that bus, because then it takes away, it draws attention. As a Black person, I don't want to have any more. And so it's okay, what are white on white people talking about?
let me ask you this, because in reality, I would not go up and slap him because of you. But what I would say it to him, and would this make you uncomfortable if I had said this? Why did you bring that up? What's that got to do with this trip that we're on?
That would be a nice thing to say, because then
Because it's like, I don't
I would
understand.
not feel, we would not have felt alone, because you don't know who's on the bus. You don't know who is supporting this guy, and I may get followed or someone call the police on us or something. Knowing that there's an ally on the bus would feel great.
Okay, that's good to know. So, white on white, what do we talk about when it comes to this kind of conversation? Now I'm having more of these conversations because of what I'm doing. I'm being more vocal, and my friends know that this is happening. But what, ha so let's just say within friends, we talk about, they'll ask me questions like, oh, I saw you were doing blah, blah, blah. And we get into a conversation about one of my latest trips, and I tell about somebody that is great, and they're like, what? And the now my friends are, of course, we tend to gravitate to people that are more like us, right? When you're in your tight knit group, you're exposed to so many during the day, and then you get into your tight knit group. So speaking to my tight knit group, we're pretty honest with each other, and they know where I am and where I'm going, and a lot of them are fascinated and want to know more in a good way. And so I tell them it's important for us to talk to each other. And there's husbands that are very conservative, and some of them that did vote for Trump, but the women did not. Or they may have the first time and they realize what a mistake they made. It fascinates me how many women turned so quickly on Hillary Clinton in comparison to this man that was caught on a bus saying the things that he was saying about women.
Can we stay on that for a little bit? Because Hillary represented them. Like, why was it, is it patriarchy? Do you support a man versus a woman? Like, why?
What was that, right?
Yeah.
I have been searching out that answer myself. I was like, what in the what? I had friends that they were afraid to tell me because I do think there is a level of the patriarchy in that. And some of my friends who haven't had to deal with the day in, day out politics of, let's call it corporate America, whatever you want to call it, but just being in business, and men are the majority. And Melissa, let's face it, you and I deal with contractors all the time, right? You got to get them to do your design. And as a woman, that annoys the easiest thing to do. You show up on a job site and it is extraordinarily monochromatic on the leadership side of it, not necessarily on the ones that are actually doing the work. We have a lot of Hispanic and people and men of color. Now we're starting to see women, but there's still that hierarchy, right? Somehow Trump represented that guy, that CEO or whatever that people look up to. Is that what we look view as a good CEO, as a good businessman, somebody who manipulates? I think that's part of it, honestly. Henry Ford did a lot of great things on creating an assembly line, but dear God, if you dig down to the character of what that man was and some of the anti-Semitism and his feeling about Black people, it wasn't good. I think it goes right down to fear. People are so fearful, and it could be of change. Seeing a powerful woman like Hillary, I would hear people even say, and women, she stayed with him. I'm like, she did. So we're going to, I'm sorry, we're going to hold this against the fact that she managed to deal, keep her family together, in spite of some publicly humiliating craziness of this guy. What Bill did, we're not going to go there. But anyway, it's like, why are you holding that against her? And it was like, okay, she's only doing it because of politics. I was like, golly, can you imagine being in her shoes? And why are we being so hard on her? I'm at a loss. I really am. I guess I feel so strongly about there are some things that are just absolutely right and absolutely wrong. Are there gray areas? Of course there are, but how many lines are we going to cross? And when you're talking about women, I don't care who the woman is, but to talk about them in a way and say that they're ugly or they have big whatevers and, you know, this, that, and other, and sexualize her, objectify her. Any woman that could support someone that speaks like that, it is way beyond my understanding.
Do you think their husbands have something to do with it?
I think it does. And some of these women do not, they depend on their husband for their living. So there probably is an element of that. I'll hear people say, I voted for him because of business and blah, blah. I'm like, I'm in business. I don't see the advantage of that. I don't understand either. It's business and the policies. And I'm like, we need to explain. I don't, what? I don't understand what you're talking about. There is fear in losing ground, I think. The whole idea of reparations and all that, I think it's got a certain, but a small segment, very terrified that they're going to lose their position. And if they lose it, we're going to start treating them like they've been treating us and treating Black people all these years. I think for a segment of white men, there are that like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And they're afraid because they've never had to work like really, like they've had to work with women and people of color, but not as their equals in their mind. I do see that fear, and it's they don't understand how to navigate it. And I've been witness recently to this man that has actually, and he's a Democrat, has actually done a lot of good, but he's also managed to keep that his network alive, and that the what we call the old boy network, right? And that wealth. And some of this is not the connections are not getting complete, let's just say, because the diversity is there and because there are people that are getting into the room, and you have to be intentional about getting the people in the room. I'm seeing a shift, and I don't have all of my thoughts pulled together of what I'm actually witnessing and seeing. I know it's coming, but what I'm seeing right now is a lot of hope. And what I'm seeing with the people that are holding on to Trump or someone like him, and that fear is because they don't understand how to walk up to you and just have a conversation because you're just a human being and not because you're Black. Were you at NeoCon last year with Michael Ford?
No.
Yeah. He's a pretty big personality. Like when you see him, that's somebody that's pretty cool. He's the hip. And I had to just take pause and watch all these white people just fawning over this guy, right? And for good reason. He's done incredible work and he's interesting to listen to. But I had to wonder if they were walking down the streets of, say, New York, would they recognize him?
Nope, absolutely not. And his topics are black topics, right? Like he's not talking about the Swedish embassy or anything, or the Country Music Hall of Fame. He's not dealing with that. He's talking about black people, black interests, black everything, black on black. So I think that the fascination of him is that he is doing something for his community and this community needs help. He's not, if he was doing something Appalachia, right?
Right.
You get what I'm going at
I
here.
do. Oh, yes. The reality, too, let's just throw it out there. The reality is the browning of the country is a real thing. Yeah. And I think, and the old guard doesn't know what to do with it. It's scaring them. It's like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to my kids? Are they going to blah, blah? It's unrealistic fear that is causing, you had brought up DEI and the anti-DEI movement. It's causing some of that because it's okay, enough. We've had enough of that. Like affirmative action, right? It's enough. We're good. No, we're not. We're not even, we're just getting started.
Let's transition into the anti-DEI movement. I'm active in AIA, American Institute of Architects, and they are really going hard on DEI. Some of the larger firms, like the HOKs or the Genslers, they are also going hard on DEI. I am curious, and I will never get this answer from them, but how are they handling clients who are part of this anti-DEI movement? Like Jeff Bezos, just his headquarters is in Northern Virginia. How is that working out for the guy who's designing it? It's one of those firms, though. Yeah, I'll look it up later. Are you hearing anything in your space regarding that?
I'm not having to deal with it as much, but here's what I am hearing. And here's where I want to give all of us a bit of hope because I'm seeing it. There are two instances I recently had with white men, one at the BIFMA conference and one with actually the Norfolk Airport Authority. And I'll tell you about both. I was at the BIFMA conference and one of the men were standing or sitting in front of me and then we had a break and we were chit-chatting. I've got his card. I can't think of his company's name right now, but anyway, I've got his card at my office because of this conversation. So he said something came up about we were in Florida and I was getting ready to go to Arizona for Angela's Women's Wealth conference. On the last night, she tells everybody, okay, everybody wear whatever. And this year it was like gold formal. I went and got a spray tan because white people in gold in the winter, it don't look good. It looks awful. I got a spray tan. He said something. He said, were you here before? And I said, oh no, I got a spray tan. But I said, let me tell you why. And so we were laughing about it. He goes, tell me more about this conference. And I did. And he said, I would love to know more, and I would love to know more of how I can help as a white man. He said, I want to be an advocate. I want to do things. I want to do more. Just saying that, it's just, let me have your card, write it down. I don't know what to tell him, what he could do, but the fact that he understands that he could be an ally and he wants to understand more about how to be an ally and what to do. That's where we start in a good way because he is going to be in rooms. He is going to be amongst these guys. And if he speaks up, if more white men speak up and say, because in their rooms and the way what happens in those rooms and the way they talk, we're all slaughtered in there. But when you have a male that stands up and says, I don't appreciate this kind of talk and stands up, it'll cut it. It'll stop it. It'll stop that what am I trying to say, where it just that chain of events of they're all just being stupid and just elevating that stupidity, cut that down. This one is really, it just filled my heart. I'm one of the commissioners for Norfolk Airport Authority, and it's a very, I didn't know it was a big political thing, but apparently it is. And they needed more women to be on the commission. And thankfully, I also have Peggy Newby, who is African-American woman, and she is also involved with Angela. She's on it too, which is very exciting. The newer CEO, so prior to Mark, there was one that had been there forever, and the Norfolk Airport's done fine, but now you could feel a real rush of all this new, it's really great. All the projects that are coming up and we're growing and blah, blah, blah. And this is the whole C-suite of the Norfolk Authority are white men, except we do have, we have an African-American woman who's COO now, so it's happening. At the meeting, I'm vice chair, and so the chairman was sick, so I had to fill in as chairman for this particular meeting. And at this particular meeting, there was a table lined up of people that were there that are employees. Now that, I'm trying to think how many employees we have there at the airport. It's probably like 500 something. It's a big number. So they were women, men, all, we've got white women, we've got African-American, male, female, and the whole table. And we have a DEI officer that is newer. Okay. So where you have the other pushing, getting out, we're coming in. Her name's Kia. I've talked to her because we're going to have some of the ELG girls go visit the airport. She's lovely. A smart, sharp girl. I just really liked her. Full of energy. They did a DEI report. And I, when it came to our report, when I had to have the chairman's report, I had things I was supposed to say, but I did this on my own. And I said, I just have to stop and say something. I am so impressed by our airport and that we're leaning in to DEI when so many people are getting out. And there's some, we've got Rear Admiral on that board. We've got, they're all leaders on that board. And I really highlighted Mark, and Mark took me aside later, and he's a white man, and he said, Susan, it is so important to me to do this DEI. And I said, Mark, thank you. You give me hope, because it's so good to hear a man just openly acknowledge that this is needed. And he says, Susan, this is how we become better. And I said, thank you. You're absolutely right. He loves that we have diversity on the board. He's a big proponent of this. He's an ally. There is hope. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, here is a big organization respected amongst our community. The way this airport's growing now, are we the biggest? I think we are in Virginia minus Dulles, but we've got some voice. So he can be an example. And he is in that room with others. And he's, you're darn right, I've got a DEI program. He's leaning in. So I want you to know there's hope. There are people that are there that see it, that want to lean in. To me, I'm not sure how HOK, whoever the talking to at Jeff Bezos or what have you, I don't know that they really have to talk about it or serve them any. They just are by action. So if we show the example that we're going to give you a better product because we have this, that's how we wake up other people. That they're like, oh, wait a minute, this is looking really good. This is a much better situation. It is. When you bring...
No. It's like work from home, right? All the metrics shows that working from home, you're more productive. These companies are making millions of dollars, but yet they want us to return to office because they're still paying for rent, or they need to see people working, or they hate their house. Like you said, DEI is working. People are seeing the success of it, and there are allies that are at the table that is pushing for this. But on the news, the courts, they want to make America great again. And they are determined to get that back. And I'm happy to hear that the needle is moving somewhere. But I am fearful. I am fearful that there will be some legislation, right? Mm-hmm. All it takes is for your governor of Virginia to get a whiff of this and wipe that DEI, rip that DEI out of the FDA or what have you. It's a fear that Marjorie Taylor Greene will put in some bill to say that any service industry, including AEC groups, can't have DEIs anymore. It's unconstitutional or whatever. It's the fear of mine.
And I can completely, I hear your fear. I hear it. And I can absolutely see where you're coming from on that. I guess what I'm saying, like with somebody like Mark, you had mentioned earlier on in this podcast about each small, starting with someone, starting. And that's how I'm looking at
Yes.
them, because I am seeing it's not happening fast enough, Melissa. It's not, but it's happening. And it will prove I am, with all that I am, I believe that it will be proven as the right thing to do, and it's going to be right for business. So let's get right down to brass tacks. If it ain't right, but for business, that's when they're going to push back. But it is. It's that's what we have to show them. That's what we have to continue to show and be that example. And all the HOKs and Ginsburgs and all that are doing that, and they stay strong. If they show how much better their organization is because of how they treat each other, that we're all seen and heard, we all have something to bring to the table when it comes to a solution to a problem, which is what your business is. That's what my business is. When you're doing design, it's all about solving a problem, right? Because in a creative way, but we're constantly like, oh, this isn't going to work, or the client doesn't like it, and we got to redo it again anyway. So we're still solving problems. We're dealing with, if you think about our industry and what we deal with, we're dealing with a lot of opinion from the client going, I don't like that. I don't care for that design. You got to grow thick skin. This is what we're teaching our designers now. It's got to listen to, we know that the client needs to go here. How do we get them there so that they feel comfortable getting there? That's the same thing that we're talking about here. How do we acknowledge that? That's what the now that's your fear. And I hear it, and it's a real fear, and it's completely legit because it scares me too. But how can we be the example to show that it's unnecessary to go there? That's where I feel like we've taken something that is logical and politicized it. I'll give you an example. This whole thing, you mentioned Virginia several times, and it doesn't escape any of us that we're capital of the Confederacy at one time. So the whole taking down the Confederate monument, which did happen in Norfolk, never thought it would, but it did happen. And when you remove, which they are being removed, and you look at some of the artwork in Richmond that's been what it was replaced with, it's even more beautiful. And it's something all of us can share. And those Confederate statues are only beloved by a small group of people. It's for the rest of us, it's what I do believe is the majority, it's very uncomfortable. It's a reminder of something that was evil and horrible in our country, but it happened. It was real. Now, I guess you could have the argument that having those statues remind you that happened, but that's not healthy. That's not a healthy way. And if anybody would take a second and just look into the why behind those Confederate monuments, it was to push down people like you, Melissa. So you didn't feel so good about yourself because you were starting to feel good about yourself. And what did they do? They put up these things to remind you, don't get too big for your pants here. Staying strong with Norfolk Airport. We're not talking a huge entity, but it's big in our community. And when you see the success that it's having and the reason behind it, that's how we win, because we'll have a bigger voice. It's being in that room and staying in that room, getting that place. You work to be that, okay, so I'm the only woman forever. I've been the only woman in so many rooms, but they had to have a woman because they had to look like they weren't all men. Okay, That's fine. I didn't, quite frankly, it was not enjoyable. I'd walk in and it was like being in high school all over again. And I know you're in those positions often where you like, where do I go? Who do I talk to? Because they're all talking to each other. And if I walk up, I'm interrupting them. Quite frankly, and I know it was not intentional, but it was that way for me at BIFMA. Just a few weeks ago, everybody knows each other. It's primarily men, and there I am. And there were some men that recognized that I was by myself, and they came over and spoke, and they were very nice. And they asked me, so where are you from? And tell me about Mantra and that kind of thing. And then asked me, because I'm white, so they're not going to bring up Obama. And thankfully, they didn't bring up Trump. And they typically don't because I'm a woman, businesswoman. It's so funny. It's thankfully, because I don't want to talk about that man. I hate to say it, but we're still in the baby step process. But I feel like we take the baby step to more of a stride if we have these conversations and there are more white allies than you probably would believe. And it makes me sad that I even have to say that because I know many are. They just don't know. Either they don't feel comfortable talking like I do, because I'll talk up a blue streak, as you can see, but they believe just as strongly as I do, but they don't necessarily know how to walk up to you and make you feel comfortable when you're the only Black person in the room. How to have a conversation. Get them to the place of having that uncomfortable conversation. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. And because I feel very received in that room. And they'll ask me questions similar to, and I'm happy to have that conversation. And I think there's more, I really believe it. I do. And I'm like, how do I get more white women in the room? I believe I can it by just doing what I'm doing now. I'm starting to talk and they're seeing that and they'll come if we invite them. But Melissa, to me, it's been far too long. It's okay. It's on the Black people to figure this out, and they need to figure out how to get into the rooms and all that. No, that's not true. White people need to do a better job at being a part of the solution with people of color, of all color, because it's unfair to just say, oh, this is your problem, not my problem. Baloney. We are in one community. We share, we all go home and fix dinner. We all are trying, we're worried to death about our kids. We have more similarities and differences. We've got a country that we've got to repair. This is not a Black, white, Latina, all this is a human thing. And just like with the border, and so often it's like they, this, they, that. Do you remember? These are children. These are people. Do we need to do something? Absolutely. But to treat it in a way of,
An invasion, because that's what they're
yes,
treating it as,
a
an
terrorist
invasion.
and all this, it just adds to the toxicity of what you and I are talking about. And we've got to be willing to have uncomfortable conversations, and we've got to be in the spaces that allow us to do
That's such a positive way to end this.
so.
Thank you so much, Susan, for coming on and having this. I don't even know what to call it. this conversation, this uncomfortable conversation. Stay on the line, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for tuning in to Architecture's Political Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode and found it informative or at least entertaining. If you like what you heard, please share with others. You can also connect with Arcus Poly on social media, currently on Instagram as well as Facebook and Twitter. For more information, visit us on our website. It's arcuspoly.online, ArchiPolly.online. I also want to thank our loyal supporters who have been with this podcast for at least 3 years. It means the world to me, and I'm totally grateful to have you part of this community. I will try to bring you the best content as possible, and I can't wait to share more amazing episodes with you. If this is your first time listening or just like a particular episode, or all of them. You can support this podcast by going on glow.fm/ArcusPoly. Again, thank you for your support. It means the world to me, and thank you so much for listening.